Can you believe that we've done 8 episodes of this now?
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's why it's called episode 8.
Okay. Is this for the podcast or just you and I chatting?
Hello and welcome to, as you've just heard, the 8th episode of the Not Mini Adults podcast, pioneers for children's healthcare and well-being. My name's David Cole, and together with my wife Hannah, we are the co-founders of children's charity Thinking of Oscar. On today's podcast, we speak to Dr. Tessa Davis. Tessa is a consultant in paediatric emergency medicine at the Royal London Hospital and also a senior lecturer in emergency and resuscitation medicine at Queen Mary University London. Tessa has spent the last 17 years working in paediatrics, having worked in both the UK and Australia. She's had a long and varied training pathway, including 4 years in the Sydney Children's Hospital during her time in Australia. Tessa has now been back in the UK for 3 years and has recently qualified as a paediatric emergency consultant, something which she says has been her greatest achievement to date, alongside setting up Don't Forget the Bubbles, a paediatric educational resource and conference where paediatric healthcare professionals from across the world can share knowledge with their peers. And that is where we get the theme of today's conversation with Tessa. It's all about the bubbles. We had such an amazing conversation with Tessa that for some reason we forgot to ask, where did the name come from for Don't Forget the Bubbles? And as you may expect, it's a nod to bubbles, the most important accessory for any paediatric healthcare professional. It's a reminder of the need for a holistic approach to paediatrics. The evidence base is core, but blowing some bubbles can be used for a multitude of purposes for sick children. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Hi, Tessa. Thank you so much for joining us on the Not Mini Adults podcast.
Thank you for having me.
No, so I think the first thing is that you've got you've worked in Australia, you've worked in the UK, you're now working in London. Can you give us a little bit of background as to what you've been doing, how you got to where you are now, please?
So I'm a consultant in paediatric emergency medicine, and I did have a long route through training, as many people do, through international moves and having my children as well. And I trained in Leeds and Manchester initially, and then we moved to Sydney for 6 years, and I was based at Sydney Children's Hospital. And when I started in the emergency department there, it's a really lovely department, I fell in love with paediatric emergency medicine. And so that's where my interest in the specialty came from. And so I trained in general peds, but also peds emergency. And then it was time to move back to the UK, sadly, to be closer to family, although we loved it there. And we're there for 6 years. And I have now been at the Royal London in Whitechapel for 3 years. And it's an excellent place to work. It's a trauma centre, so we get a lot of varied presentations. It's a very busy department. And it's a team that I love as much as I love Sydney Children's Hospital.
Yeah, and I lived in Randwick for a while as well, so so I know it well, and obviously beautiful surroundings from that perspective. And I guess your time in London, especially over the last few months, must have been interesting.
It has. So it was. Things are now settling more back to normality. But yeah, it was busy. It was unexpected. And for me, it really showed the best of the NHS, because you can get bogged down with a lot of bureaucracy. I'm sure you guys have seen it when you're trying to implement things. But this was really medicine and healthcare at its best, because we basically had 2 weeks to get ready, and getting ready just involved revising absolutely everything about the way we worked, where we saw patients, how we saw them, what we did to treat them. And we were able to make changes that previously would likely have taken months or years in 2 weeks, and changed the entire way our very large emergency department was ready to see and treat patients. And it was such a transformation, and it meant that when the peak of COVID happened, we really were very well prepared, and we were ready for it to hit, which it did. But that preparation time was key, and it was a beautiful thing to see.
And I know this is not going to be the main topic of our conversation today, but I'm curious about, of those changes that you implemented, are there any that are working so well that you want to keep them in perpetuity, or was it all about managing your way through the situation appropriately?
No, I think there will be some that we keep. And I know, I mean, medicine as a whole has changed a lot of the way we see patients. I mean, there's a lot more virtual options that weren't available to us before. And even personally, I mean, all the times you go to meetings and travel to meetings, and you realize now that actually you can achieve a lot without having all that travel time. And that's the same for patients. There's obviously unique challenges in the emergency department versus follow-up outpatient clinics. But I think a lot of things within RED, but also more broadly, are going to be embedded for the future in the NHS.
So our topic of conversation, I guess, I think we've actually called it bubbles, but I think the topic is really around education. And some people, I guess, certainly in the UK, may have seen you recently on Sky News talking about some of the work that you're doing, which we will touch on later. But I think to open it up, can you talk a little bit about Don't Forget the Bubbles and how that started and you know, the initiative, what it's doing, please?
So Don't Forget the Bubbles is a group of healthcare professionals who provide free medical education. That's its core. And it's this concept of FOAM, which is free open access medical education. And that means anyone can use the free resources and share them, and the idea is for that to broadly improve education. And FOAM is a concept that's been going for many years, and it was started by Mike Cadogan, who's an Australian. And he created this website called Life in the Fast Lane, which is the biggest emergency medicine online website. And it was around when I was in Sydney, so it was 7 years ago. I'd been in Sydney, I'd started work there. I joined Twitter, and this world was opening up where there was all these clinicians starting to connect online, and Life in the Fast Lane existed, and the concept of FOAM. And there was nothing like that for pediatrics. So this was, Life in the Fast Lane was for emergency, but there was no pediatric thing. And so I basically put out a tweet to say, does anyone fancy starting a pediatric blog? And three lonely humans replied who I'd never met before. They were, I wouldn't say it was a highly competitive process. They were the only three people who replied. And so we started up DFTV. We spent, I think it was like 3 months or something like that, maybe slightly longer, getting, I think we had 100 posts on the site before we launched, and a plan for the first 3 months so that we would keep having content for the first 3 months so that there was stuff, because there's nothing worse than starting a blog that you can't keep going. Hey, and then we launched it, and it's kind of taken off from there. But the core of it is the same, which is that we are all healthcare professionals who volunteer our time to create this education in different ways online.
And talk to us about why it's, you know, so important, especially from a pediatric perspective. I mean, we'll put the link to obviously the website in the show notes and everything. And, you know, I've looked through it and it's extensive. But and we talked a little bit to Damien Rowland, who I know you know well, on one of our podcasts, you know, around the importance of education, around the importance of connecting people. But, you know, this is doing that at a pretty extensive level.
I think our key things are the connection and the making meaning out of science for clinicians. So, you know, we're not, Damien is an academic. He is someone who does the research, who's super smart. Some of us are just mere plebs who just try to treat the patients that we see as best we can. And the question is, you can read a journal and read the articles, but you're thinking at the end, but what does this mean for me when I see the next patient with this problem? And that's what we try to do. It's the knowledge translation. It's making it relatable to clinicians, so digesting the information, making it understandable, and making it meaningful for our clinical practice. But it's also the network and connection, because it's very like I work in a big hospital, so I've got you know, a number of colleagues around me. But even then, there may be, I don't know, 10 of us, say, who might sit in a room and at a journal club and talk about it. But if you can connect with people from all over the world, then you bring more meaning to that. And there's plenty of people in Australia, where I was at the time, who are in rural hospitals, who don't have many colleagues, or maybe any colleagues. And actually there's people all over the world who are all healthcare professionals like you. They're all asking the same questions about how they treat a child, what medications they should use, what the latest evidence is, all asking the same questions in different parts of the world. And what we do is we bring them together, not just through reading on the website, but through our network, through our social channels, through our meetings. And so we have this sense of community where everyone feels like they're working together to do the same thing, which is to treat our patients as best as we can.
And it sounds like an important thing about what you're doing there. You talked about accelerating understanding, but if I put myself in what I perceive it is like to stand in your shoes, then you're so busy running your own lives and your professional lives. And then the time that is required to reflect on developments or reflect on some complicated issues, you don't have big pockets of time to do that. So I imagine that you are helping people find solutions much more quickly because of the digestible information that you share with them.
Yeah, exactly. So we try to keep all our posts to being readable within 5-10 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's really, we don't have a word limit, but that's roughly what we say. So that if you've got that, we recognize that people have 5 minutes on the bus or 5 minutes in their toilet break, that they might have a flick through of information. And it's to make that something that's easy for them to access rather than having to pull out a textbook or try and read through a journal article that they can't, you cannot possibly digest in that time. So yeah, it's accessible, it's in digestible chunks, and it's by your peers. That's the aim of it.
So do you have numbers around how many people that you've got actually reading or contributing to the?
So we have now, we've got over 4,500 views per day. Wow. And that's built up a lot over the last few. So there was a slow first few years, I won't lie to you. But it's built up, and certainly over the last few years, we've grown the number of people contributing in the community. And so, yeah, that's increasing. So we've got, we're about to hit 10K followers on Twitter, and we've got the same on Facebook and our website and podcasts and so on.
Incredible. I've got a question for you, which if I try and explain it to people, I kind of describe it as linearity of learning. And I'm curious about what your point of view on it is. So the way I see our education system working, it's quite linear. So you go from year to year to year, you do subject to subject to subject. Normally it's kind of vertical learning rather than kind of horizontal. You do some horizontal topic learning, but normally in the education system it's quite vertical. And then as you get older, you'll have a set of requirements you need to understand, and you sit an exam in order to be tested on whether you understand those areas, and then you pass or you fail. And then if you progress through into medicine, then, and now my level of understanding is less personal because we had a very short period of time when we were in hospital with Oscar, but we looked at how professionals collaborate with one another. And it's still, there's some triaging going on with respect to where you'll have a generalist that will then talk to a cardiac specialist or a neuro specialist or whatever, but they'll have an idea about what they might try, and then they'll try it, and then you wait 48 hours and then you see how it looks, and then you try something else and you wait another 48 hours. Or the whole system from birth through to, you know, being professionals feels like a really linear learning process, if that makes sense to you. And what I'm interested about is there value in, or is there movements towards helping people learn in different ways now that the problems that people are trying to solve are so complicated, now that you've got access to skills all over the world, not limited to those in your department? And how can we evolve? What's the next stage for learning?
I mean, I think that people are evolving. So I'm sure there's some kind of old-fashioned areas or departments or whatever, but I think things have changed. I think in a way COVID's probably propelled that even further, because everyone is having to connect online, not just with the people that they see face to face. And so that's essentially a version of what we were doing already through DFTB, but everyone's been propelled into that. So it's through connecting with other people, hearing other people's practice and opinion, that's how you're going to evolve your own practice, as well as different ways of in actual learning and repetition and so on. But I think really it's through your professional network. No one can be the best doctor they can be on their own. And COVID has really propelled us into forcing us to do that.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And what about, so it came up, it might come up in the Damien conversation, it certainly came up in an earlier podcast where we were talking about new disciplines emerging. So in that particular case, we were discussing informatics and how at the minute in worldwide, I think there are a few courses you can do over in the States, but if you decide that you want to be you want to specialize in clinical informatics, as one example, then there isn't really a clear career path in order to qualify in that area. So is that, I imagine that in Don't Forget the Bubbles, there'll be some emerging threads that you can see more people contributing to, or, you know, what's the role there about supporting emerging disciplines or emerging areas of interest?
Yeah, I think, look, there's always going to be new things emerging and new fields, and we should be fostering that. And I feel like I keep banging on about connection, but that's exactly what you need to do. If you're the only person starting your new specialty, it's going to be a real challenge. And if there is someone on the other side of the world in Sydney or wherever doing the same thing, then that's who you should be connecting with. And part of what we can do as a DFTB is bring all these people together, because and that's one of the beauties of Twitter or social media, is that you have access to all these people that you normally in a previous world or generation there was no chance you would be able to approach them or contact them at all, whereas now you can tweet them, I saw your article on this, or what do you think about this, and they will answer you, and the hierarchy is gone. It doesn't matter if you're a trainee and they're a professor, and that's what's so beautiful about it, that it brings people together. And that's how you're going, if you have your niche interest, you can connect with people with their niche interest and make it better that way.
So you've got an initiative at the minute, which I think, again, you know, there's a few very topical subjects, which Don't Forget the Bubble seems to be, you know, examining and looking at and working towards. So can you talk to us about the Skin Deep initiative that you've got, that you were on Sky News for, and you've been, you know, obviously talking to other outlets about?
Yeah, so Skin Deep we launched a few weeks ago, and the aim of Skin Deep is to increase the diversity of pediatric images online. And we all know that when you look online for images, so if your child has measles, for example, you think your child's got measles or chickenpox, whatever, and you Google chickenpox, you'll see hundreds of rashes of chickenpox on children with white skin. And if you do not have white skin, or your child does not have white skin, you're not seeing that reflected back at you when you search. And that makes it difficult for our families. And they tell us that when they come into hospital. So it makes it difficult for parents. But also it's important as clinicians to be able to recognize skin conditions regardless of what skin tone your patient has, to make sure you give a timely diagnosis, you give the right management. And this has been a long-term problem, and actually it's not a new problem, and it's also not a new solution to that problem. So dermatologists for years have been creating textbooks trying to share the images online, and so there's a lot of work, many years of work that's gone in from people you know, much more experienced than us in this. And so what we've done is just try to build on the work they've done by putting some of these images online and making them freely available. And so the project, which is, there's a team of, this is now 17 of us who are on the core team across the globe, collecting and collating these images. They're getting reviewed by a dermatologist just to check that the diagnosis is correct, and then we are posting them online, and they're free, open access, and they should and can be shared widely. And they're going to be used in traditional textbooks, they're going to be used on other online websites, so that when the next person comes to search measles or search chickenpox, that they will see reflected back a version of their own child's skin color, rather than just seeing 500 white skin rashes online.
And do you have an exhaustive list, or are you looking for more images? Are you working with other people across the world in order to boost that, boost the picture library that you have at the minute?
Yeah, so we've got 90 images since we started a few weeks ago. We've got about another 50 that are awaiting dermatology review. And the idea is to build up lots. So we're not doing a list of, do you have a rash of chickenpox or rubella. We're getting as many as we can. And that's because rashes look different in different people, not to do with skin tone, just to do with humans and rashes. So we could have 50 photos of eczema. They'd all look slightly different. And that will be reassuring if your child has eczema and you look it up and you see there's actually variations and this is one that matches your child. So we're collecting as many images as we can. And we have our team spans everywhere from the UK to the States to Australia to Kenya, to Sierra Leone. So we've got loads of people collecting images, as well as we're very happy to take individual submissions from parents if they've got photos of their own kids. So yeah, the goal is to build up as many as we can and to share them as widely as we can.
But it goes beyond just pictures, doesn't it? Because I was watching the news article where you were interviewed, and I think one of the features or one of the segments that they were talking about beforehand was just in terms of the you know, if you've got someone on the end of the phone and they're saying, is your child turning blue? And okay, if you've got a white child, then yes, that might be the case. But if you've got a child with a different colored skin tone, you know, a dark black skin, for example, that's not necessarily going to be the case. So are you doing anything in that area? Are you helping?
Yeah, so we're broad. We're not just specific to rashes. So we've got a photo of a jaundiced baby, for example, there. So you can see that the eyes have turned a yellow color. And we're also doing, we're going to be starting an area around genetic syndromes and rare conditions. And we've got one person on the core team who's leading on that. Because similarly, if you have a child with Down syndrome, if you look up... Also, as a clinician, when you're revising for your exams, if you look up Down syndrome or you look up Turner syndrome or whatever, you're going to see Caucasian children. So we're working with the rare diseases and genetic syndrome organizations to try and get more broad and more diverse images of these children online as well. So it's not just skin, it's all diverse images of young people.
Yeah, not before time, I guess, in a lot of aspects. In terms of the don't forget the bubbles. So obviously we've talked about the online efforts that you've been doing, but you're also now a conference as well. Now, obviously, you were not in 2020, but 2019. Unfortunately, we missed it in 2019. It clashed with the big bike ride that we had. It was probably just one thing too many. But I think you've already got a date for 2021.
Yeah, we did. And so, yeah, we've run a conference for 3 years in a row, and that really helped to bring the connection that you feel online. You cannot replace that that feeling of meeting people face to face and talking to them. And really, when you know people from Twitter, even though you've not met them, you do know them. You really do. And I talked about the three people who answered my tweet to start a pediatric blog, and they are now my closest friends. And actually, we didn't meet face to face until that first conference, which was 4 years after we started. But we speak every day online. We're very close friends. And when you meet up with your professional community in an environment that people feel happy and relaxed, because it's a DFTB thing, it's learning, but it's in a fun way, that's actually a really nice environment to connect, but also to go away feeling refreshed, feeling motivated about going to work and reinvigorated. And we really found that having that face-to-face conference made that difference. We're running it online this year, DFTB Live, instead of what we were going to be running it, which was in Brisbane this year, and we'll run Brisbane next year. So there are places for running online conferences, and we're trying our best to replicate that connection. And it's difficult. Hopefully, I'm hoping it will go well. We're thinking of interesting ways to make people feel like they've managed to chat to someone, rather than just watching a lecture on a Zoom call. So it'll be a new experience for us. It's in a few weeks' time. We'll see how it goes.
So we were talking just before we started recording that you've done a lot of work in Australia, but you're also starting to do work in other parts of the world as well. So can you talk to us a little bit about the work that you've done in Africa and Kenya?
Well, we're keen to support our colleagues in lower middle income countries, and we're trying to work out ways that we can support them through education. So, for example, for the DFTB Live that's coming in a few weeks, it's free access for anyone in a lower middle income country. And we did that we actually live streamed our conferences in the previous years as well for free to lower middle income countries. And we're working with some of these countries for Skin Deep as well in some departments. But one of the things that we're hoping to get more involved with is with PEC Kenya. So that's Pediatric Emergency and Critical Care Kenya. So in Kenya, there is no pediatric emergency doesn't exist as a specialty. And there's a group of clinicians there who have started to train a number of fellows in pediatric emergency medicine. And it's such a huge undertaking creating a specialty that doesn't exist. We take it for granted, when we talk about improving peds training, you're working on a foundation of years and years of experts, but when you're starting from scratch, it's kind of mind-blowing to know where you would begin. But they've set up a fellowship where they train three fellows a year, and it's over a two-year program. And as part of that, they have placements in various hospitals around Kenya, but they also have intensive teaching, week-long programs. And I went out to Kenya, to Kajabi, which is about an hour and a half from Nairobi, in February to teach on that. And as the DFTB team, we are going to be running a regular week-long intensive in Kenya. We were hoping to do it face to face, but I'm guessing it might be more likely to be online. And essentially trying to work with them about how to help them deliver education in COVID now, because a lot of what they relied on was external people going out to teach. And obviously that's going to be even more difficult now. So online learning is going to be very important for them. And that's something we want to work with them to help support.
Amazing. And so from your perspective, what's next? What else would you like to do from an education point of view?
So we've got our main things this year, the Skin Deep and DFTB Live, and we've got our project that we've just launched is that we've been lucky enough to have a DFTB fellow at the Royal London over the last year. So they get one day a week to work on DFTB stuff, and they've been leading on developing this project, which is a number of teaching modules. And this is also for global education. So anyone in any hospital or any unit anywhere in the world who sees sick children can pick up this module on asthma, for example. And it gives you, it's like a facilitated module. So it doesn't give you a PowerPoint slide, but it gives you topical cases and discussion points. And it points you to the evidence around how to answer these questions. And you can adapt the teaching modules to the level of your learner. And so we've launched, the fellows have been leading this project for the last 9 months, and they launched them 2 weeks ago. And they've launched with 15 modules. There's another 30 in various stages of development. And so again, this is part of the global education, and it's completely free that anyone can pick them up and run them. So I think what's forward for us is trying to think of more and new ways to connect globally, so that the education we provide can be applicable to whatever resource setting you're in, or whatever number of colleagues or types of presentations you have. Also on the radar is trying to find some, we're looking at finding funding for DFTB, so it's all free, it's all provided free, and we put in our time for free, but there's obviously a cost to providing foam education, and so we actually don't have any external funding. So that's something that we're going to look to over the next 6 months. And that's because we've grown. And so having 4,500 website views a day, it comes with a cost. So I think these are the funding ones probably important, but our key is looking at these new projects that we're doing on the education side and really growing the team and growing the people who are working with DFTB. For us, it's very, it's something we've been doing for 7 years. It's been one of the most important things for my professional career. So for the four of us who started it 7 years ago and the nine of us that now run it, it's really important to make that sustainable going forward.
Fantastic. I know you won't have had a chance to hear it yet because you've had a busy weekend by the sounds of it, but The question I'm about to ask you, when we asked Damien, which was, if you could change anything within within child health, what would it be? His answer was that he felt that at any university, when you've got children or you've got young adults coming out and finishing university who are ultimately, you know, more often than not, probably going to go on to be parents, there should be a level of education for them around just children and their needs and what they're going to, what it's going to be like, I guess, moving forward. I just wondered what your view on that was, whilst giving you a split second to think about your answer to the question.
My view on Damien's point, or my view on what?
Yeah, no, on your point, yeah, on Damien's point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think we should be providing education. Obviously, that's my thing. So yeah, I would definitely support that. As far as my answer to what we could do to improve healthcare, I feel that there's a lot of families that come to ED who are worried about their children, reasonably worried, because maybe this kind of look actually ties in with Damien's answer. And so they come when they don't necessarily need an emergency department, but actually that's the place they know where to go to. And bringing them into the emergency department adds an element of risk. As I know you guys are well aware of all the risks that come with being in a hospital in the first place. And I think if there's ways that we can support families more to help keep them at home where it's safe for them to do so, that would be a really important step forward, and it would have a lot of knock-on effects. And maybe that is exactly that maybe ties into what Damien said, I guess, in a slightly different way. So I hope that's something that we can do in the coming years.
Well, you would hope that the technology that is starting to be seen, you know, used more ubiquitously around in terms of telehealth will allow that to happen. And
yeah, I hope so.
You would certainly advocate for that. So, Tessa, thank you so much for your time. We will make sure that absolutely we're adding, you know, links to all of the work that we've talked about today on the show notes for this, so people that can get in touch. And anyone that's not aware in the pediatric community of Don't Forget the Bubbles will hopefully be able to find you guys and, benefit from all the amazing work that you're doing. And I think, you know, education has certainly been something that we've picked up on since we started this journey, as it were, just in the need for more education around technology coming into healthcare. And I speak a lot in all walks of life around, if you think about how our children are embracing technology at the minute in their everyday lives, they're going to want to see that in, you know, if they're unfortunately having to go to hospital. So more and more around education and technology is just, you know, paramount, I think, as we move forward. So thank you so much for your time. Enjoy the rest of your house move.
Thank you. I'll get back to unpacking more cardboard boxes.
And we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks.
It never ceases to amaze me how generous people are with the time. And if you imagine the amount of time that Tessa and her peers have put into Don't Forget the Bubbles, it's an unfathomable amount of time on top of her busy work life and home life.
Absolutely. She's got three kids as well, and obviously she's at the she really is at the forefront of emergency medicine in the middle of a very, very busy area of London.
It was amazing. I really enjoyed the conversation. I think that the comment that Tessa made at the end was quite similar to the sentiment that Damien had shared with us recently in answer to your question about what's the one thing that you would do to change healthcare for pediatrics. So hers was about, you know, how can you, that there is an element of risk if you take your child into hospital. And so what ways are there to keep families at home wherever possible and keep them safer? I'm really interested to learn more about the global progress on that. And I know from a project I've been involved in with my professional hat on recently about work that's happening with older patients, about keeping an hospital a home type programs and keeping them out of the hospital setting and in a setting that is better for their care and better for their recovery. And I'd love to understand more about similar initiatives that might be happening to keep younger patients out of the hospital setting as well, or really any. I wonder what the stats are, and they're going to be really different now to life pre-COVID of your hospital population, how many of them really need to be there, and what the future operating model for, I'm being geeky about it now, I realise, but for me it's interesting, what's the future operating model for hospitals and how do you optimise care?
Thank you so much to Dr. Tessa Davis for joining us this week, and thank you to you and everybody else who has listened to our podcasts over the last few weeks. You can find details of today's podcast in the show notes, including links to Don't Forget the Bubbles, and also ways in which you can contact us. As ever, if you know of someone that you think we should be talking to, then please do get in touch. Equally, if there are themes that you would like us to cover on the podcast, then we'd really love to hear from you. Next week's podcast, we will be speaking to Professor Joe Wilmshurst from the Cape Town Children's Hospital in South Africa. And the theme of the conversation will be all about listening. We hope you can join us then.